Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back here to the program David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. And once a month, always on a Friday, he is here to talk a little bit about money management issues. And he comes prepared to talk a little bit about some particular topic here in the beginning. Sometimes could be a particular financial planning issue. Sometimes talks a little bit about what things look like with the economy right at the moment. And then if you have questions about that or anything else that has to do with financial planning, I know he will do his best to help you out, and you can give us a call. Right now, we'll get things started, and we'll say welcome back. Pleased once again, as always, to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. It's a genuine pleasure, of course, to be with you. And I would also like to take this opportunity to wish all of the wonderful friends, the wonderful listeners of WILL, a very healthy and very joyous holiday season. Well, 2008 certainly has been a roller coaster ride for investors. Large swings in stock market prices are becoming a daily event. We heard them just 3 minutes ago. The Dow was up, 150 points, etc. And of course, the residential home market, as we all have been reading about, seeing literally 24/7, is indeed a mess in many areas of the country, especially California, Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. We spent a great deal of time on that last month. Now, all of us, of course, have seen the ugly foreclosure and auction signs as well as half-constructed developments littering the landscape. We see those on nightly news. Many commentators are predicting that by the fall of 2009, as many as 3 million homeowners will be in default on their current mortgage obligations, and approximately two-thirds of those loans will end up in foreclosure. Bailout plans for many of these borrowers are being proposed by the Federal Reserve, the Department of the Treasury, as well as the executive and congressional branches of government. And not a lot has been accomplished in that area. A lot of arguing, a lot of bickering back and forth. Oh, yes, there was a piece of legislation signed yesterday that said if you happen to be one of those folks with a subprime mortgage and you're lucky enough to have your lender renegotiate with you and forgive some of that debt and essentially change the terms, that debt forgiveness will not be considered taxable income. So, David, if you owed me $50,000, and because it's the holiday season, I just said, David, you no longer owe it to me. That's forgiveness of debt. And theoretically and actually practically, you would be required to report that $50,000 as income, taxable income, because that was forgiveness of a legitimate debt. But under this new legislation, apparently, if debt is forgiven on one of these subprime mortgages, then that's not going to be taxable income to that particular homeowner or individual. The question, of course, is will that really help? I'm really not sure. The evidence, of course, is still out on that. But here are some facts that we know to date. The biggest money center and investment banks in the United States hold vast pools of these defaulting mortgages and have already written off tens of billions of dollars of losses. Second, Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Fed, has been quoted as saying that the actual losses in the subprime market may well be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So expect a whole lot more write-downs by major holders of these mortgages. Three, banks are very skittish about loaning their excess cash reserves at the end of the night to other banks because of the deteriorating balance sheets of banks holding these subprime mortgages. That's called Fed funds. So rather than loaning them overnight, banks are saying, no, if we have excess liquidity, we're a little bit skittish, we're a little concerned about even loaning money overnight to other banks. Four, we know that credit is tougher for everyone, whether you're in the business world, the business environment, or indeed buying a home. I was visiting with folks yesterday at Revere Mortgage, and they said, hey, you can still certainly get a mortgage. It just takes longer. Every I has to be dotted. Every T has to be crossed. It's not like the old days. Five, in order for a bank to loan out money, they need deposits, right? And many national money market funds are cutting back their purchases of certificates of deposits in these banks. Typically, if we own a national money market fund, that national money market fund will consist of bank certificates of deposits, sometimes bank repos backed, interestingly enough, by mortgages, as well as commercial paper, that short-term IOU corporate paper. So that's usually what comprises money market funds. And money market funds are now saying, gee, I'm not so certain if I want to own uninsured bank certificates of deposit in major banks. So that's creating a liquidity crisis for large banks. They don't have money to close loans with their customers. So guess what happened this week? The Federal Reserve said, let's have an auction. Let's auction off about $80 billion of money to banks that need money at an interest rate so they can borrow from us short term, so they can then loan that money out to their bank customers so we don't have this exacerbation of credit issues for banks and loaning money out for banks. And finally, we're seeing something else very, very troubling, at least in my view. We're seeing something called sovereign wealth funds. These are funds that are owned internationally, typically by major governments and somewhat major private consortiums. And these sovereign wealth funds, for example, the Sovereign Wealth Fund of China, is an enormous fund, and it is now taking some of its billions and billions of dollars and buying up positions in U.S. companies, especially companies that are finding themselves in trouble as a result of this subprime mortgage crisis. For example, China Investment Corporation, a sovereign wealth fund, just infused $5 billion into Morgan Stanley. The Abu Dhabi Investment Authority recently invested $7.5 billion in Citigroup. I think that's a troubling matter. It's estimated that these sovereign wealth funds have approximately $2 trillion of capital, just waiting for the right opportunities to invest their money. Now, I may not be a Philadelphia lawyer, but I don't feel real comfortable with a lot of foreign governments investing in some of our major corporations. What bothers me is not the economic issues. What bothers me are the political issues that could come as a result of those kinds of investments. Now, I'm not in the prediction business. You know I've never been in the prediction business, but I feel pretty confident in the following assumptions. One, I think housing prices will continue to decline in 2008. Two, I think foreclosures will continue to escalate in 2008. Three, I think Congress will be its typical self. After all, it's a presidential year. It will be extraordinarily slow to pass any kind of legislation dealing with the subprime loan crisis. One, because it's pretty hard to figure out what kind of legislation would make sense. And four, I think obtaining credit, extending credit, will remain tight in 2008. So given these assumptions, here are the financial moves that I'm taking currently. I'm suggesting that you take these financial moves, and I have already made these moves for my clients and, most importantly, for my spouse, Carol. Okay? So I'm just going to tell you what I have done myself, and you can take it or leave it, of course, because we have to be careful when anyone just gives advice, as David always points out. These are my personal feelings. First and most importantly, I have substantially exited all generic national money market funds. Okay? If you hold a generic national money market fund, I want you to take a careful look at that fund and see what kind of securities are comprised in that fund. In any event, I've exited them and I've taken that money and I have purchased Treasury money market funds. Now, the typical generic money market fund owns bank certificates of deposit. It owns bank repos, sometimes backed by subprime mortgages, and commercial paper. In other words, many of these national money market accounts have some exposure, we're not sure how much, but some exposure to bank balance sheets. Now, I'm not suggesting these generic money funds will trade at less than a dollar per share. I'm not going to say that, because historically, money market funds nationally have almost always traded at a dollar a share. but I'm simply not willing to take the chance. So I have simply transferred from one money market fund to another. Almost all mutual fund companies have a Treasury money market fund. Now, a few words of caution. Make certain your Treasury money market fund is 99% plus U.S. Treasury bills. You don't want anything else. You want a T-bill money market fund. Now, we know that we're going to sacrifice a little bit of interest rate yield compared to a generic money market fund, maybe as much as 0.5%. But I think in the short run, even though a Treasury money market fund will earn less interest than the generic money market fund, I think it's a time to preserve capital in money market funds. So I think that would be move number one. I'm telling you that I have already made that particular move. So if you're thinking about looking at a Treasury money market fund, make sure that that fund basically is a T-bill money market fund. It should have a maturity of somewhere between 60 and 90 days. That's what most of these funds have. And, of course, treasuries are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Remember that treasury interest is subject to federal income tax. So when you get dividends on your treasury money market fund, you're going to pay taxes on those dividends. That's fair. But treasury interest is not subject to state of Illinois income tax. So if you're an Illinois resident, you don't pay state of Illinois income tax. No state income tax on that treasury interest instrument. Second, because I believe that credit will remain tight in 2008, smaller companies and essentially smaller value companies are going to have a harder time borrowing money, continuing to expand, and growing. They're certainly going to have a harder time than larger companies who are better capitalized to deal with short-term financial stress. Therefore, commencing January 1, I am altering the asset allocation of my couch potato portfolio. So when you get ready to rebalance your couch potato portfolio, if you are in it, then effective January 1 or January 2, here is what I suggest. This is what I'm going to do. I am increasing my S&P 500 position from 10% to 15% of my equity portfolio. Okay? Currently, the couch potato portfolio has 10% S&P 500. I'm moving from 10 to 15% S&P 500. Second, I am reducing small cap value exposure. It's currently 16.5% of the portfolio to 10% of the portfolio. So that's a 6.5% reduction in small cap value. Third, I am increasing total international index from 25% to 26.5% of the portfolio. So I've just eaten up that 6.5% from small cap value. 5% went into S&P 500. The remaining 1.5% went into total international. Everything else remains the same. Large value remains at 16.5%. The mid caps remain at 10%. Small caps remain at 10. The REIT, which has had an awful year, remains at 7%. And emerging markets, which has had a terrific run this year, remains at 5%. And if you add all that up, hopefully, mathematically, that will add up to 100%. Incidentally, through yesterday's close, our couch potato portfolio for the year, inclusive of dividends, is up 3.6%. As compared to our benchmark S&P, if you were just in the S&P, we're trailing the S&P, because the S&P, inclusive of dividends through yesterday's close, was up about 4.75% for the year. So we're trailing the S&P by a little bit more than 1%. The best performing asset classes are, of course, in the international sphere. Our total international index up over 12% for the year, and emerging markets up a screaming 34.5% for the year. Our worst performing indexes, the REITs, which have had a terrific run until this particular year, down about 17% this year, and we have 7% of our money in the REITs, so that's 7% of a negative 17, and small cap value, which is having a difficult time, down about almost 7% for the year. If you were a bond investor interestingly enough. And remember, you're doing both. You have some of your money in equities. You have a percentage of your money in fixed income. If that fixed income was in bonds, you probably had a good run. The average bond fund was up about 6.5% for the year. And if you were in inflation-protected securities, which have a very, very low interest rate, of course, but then compound at the rate of inflation, they have just been on fire this year with double-digit returns. And they have made a very, very good hedge against an equity portfolio. So there you have it, David. Those are the moves that I'm making in my portfolio for next year. I'd be delighted to answer questions about the issues I've raised or certainly tackle other questions from our listening audience.
All right. David Sinnoh is our guest. He is a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I and is on this program once a month, always a Friday, to talk about personal finance. And again, as Dave says, if you have questions about any of that or anything else that has to do with financial planning, he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here, someone who has been patient and waiting, and we'll get right to them. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Hello. Good
yes.
morning.
Yes.
Thank you for that excellent overview. It really helped me understand the situation a lot. My question, however, is a quasi-legal question, and I have seen an attorney about putting a small amount of money, less than $500,000, into a living trust. And since most of my money is in IRAs, I was told by the attorney that that wasn't necessary, that a living trust really was most useful for people who are above $500,000. And do you have any comment on that? I know you're not a lawyer, and I'm not asking for a legal opinion.
Well, actually, interestingly enough, I have been licensed as an attorney for more than 30 years.
Okay.
And I do teach estate planning as part of the courses that I teach in the wealth management area at the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So I have some information on trust that I'd be delighted to share with you.
Please.
First of all, a living trust is a trust that you execute during your life, as opposed to a trust that comes into fruition at your death called a testamentary trust. So it would, for example, you could execute a trust, and I have one myself. It's called the David Sinnoh Revocable Living Trust, under agreement dated. And there's a date to that trust when you execute the trust. Now, a living trust typically is amendable or revocable, which means that you can always change it. Typically, your trust would make you the trustee of your own trust, so long as you are living, as well as the beneficiary of your own trust. Is that the case in your trust?
Yes.
Right. And you're also the author of the trust, which means that you are the grantor. I always refer to authors of the trust. The legal term is grantor. Now, what are the advantages of a trust? First of all, a trust is a private document, which means that at the time that an individual dies, if they have a trust, that trust document does not become part of the probate estate, and therefore it is never a public document. And indeed, if all of your assets, with the exception of IRAs and things like that, are already titled in the trust, it totally avoids probate and it totally avoids public purview. So those are huge advantages to have in a trust. Also, for people who have essentially estates, and this is usually for a married couple, estates in excess of $2 million, there is a tax advantage of setting up a revocable living trust. Indeed, it's possible to save several hundreds of thousands of dollars of tax with the utilization of a revocable living trust. Each of the married couple have one of these items. Now, I presume that you are not married at the current time. Is that correct? Okay. And so you have established a revocable living trust.
No, I haven't, but I'm interested in it.
Oh, okay. All right. So if you're interested in doing that, that's only part of the process. Because once you and there is no downside, by the way, to having a revocable living trust. Mm-hmm. All right? There is no downside. because you can always tear it up. You can always amend it. It doesn't require a new tax identification number. You're operating under your own Social Security number. But that's only half the battle, because what is necessary to do once you draft one of these things and you sign it, then you retitle your assets into the revocable living trust. Now, you don't retitle IRAs, pension funds, things like that, but you would retitle your property, your bank accounts, any assets that you hold outside of IRA or investments that pass directly to a named beneficiary. You follow me?
Yes.
Because otherwise, then you're right back to the probate courts. So in other words, if I have a very nice revocable living trust, but I have a $100,000 account in Merrill Lynch in my name, and I die, that $100,000, because it wasn't titled in the revocable living trust, still goes through the probate process. Even if my will says, oh, by the way, I have this $100,000 account, please put it in my trust at death. It will eventually end up there, but it would still go through the probate process. So you would need to retitle your assets. And then, basically, your estate plan is really laid out in your trust. Typically, a trust will have a successor trustee. So in the event that you became incapacitated at some point in your lifetime, that there would be someone else who you would appoint to deal with your trust, distribute income for your benefit, for your health, welfare, etc. And then at your death, typically in the trust, there are provisions which lay out specifically how these assets get transferred. Does that sort of explain it?
That is very good. However, my question is, since most of our money is in IRAs, would a living trust be useful for us?
Well, if most of your money is in your IRAs, do you have specific named beneficiaries for your IRAs?
Yes.
And you're happy with those named beneficiaries?
I'm not totally happy.
Okay. Well, this is another issue, because what typically happens is that people will name individuals first as their primary beneficiaries, if they're happy with them. And then if the primary beneficiary is no longer around, passes away, predeceases you, then there are contingent beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the living trust is named as a contingent beneficiary. And sometimes even it's named as the primary beneficiary, but there can be tax disadvantages of doing that. So it's very important to discuss that with your attorney and your accountant to make certain the way the documents are drawn and the way your beneficiary designations are stated that there are no negative income tax disadvantages to naming a trust as the ultimate beneficiary. So it's a little bit more complicated.
And so the advice I was given, that because I have most of our money in IRAs, I should not transfer that to a living trust.
Absolutely not. No, you do not transfer IRA money into a living trust. That kind of money doesn't get transferred. You can transfer things that are just titled in your name, okay? Not things that are already going to a named beneficiary, which is basically pre-tax money.
Okay. So it cannot ever be in a living trust.
No, you never put an IRA and transfer it in, because that would, first of all, immediately cause an income tax impact. All right? So if you had a $100,000 IRA and you retitled it into a living trust, one, you would never do it, but if you did, you'd report $100,000 of income. Okay? So that would not be a good idea.
Okay.
Okay?
I understand now.
Okay. My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
We'll continue. And the next caller here is in Urbana. It's line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about rebalancing your portfolio. And through a small inheritance, I'm going to have an opportunity to invest some new money. And I'm wondering if the strategy of boldly going where no one wants to go right now, and you were mentioning the REIT, if that might not be a strategy in a long-term horizon of 15 to 20 years to take advantage of the things that are currently down in my portfolio and maybe investing within some boundaries a little more heavily than you might otherwise want to.
Okay, I'm not going to be adverse to that, other than if I was going to do that, I would certainly dollar cost average into that position. So if you were thinking, for example, of having a REIT exposure of 10 to 15% as opposed to a 5 to 10%, I'm not going to stand in your way, but what I would suggest is that you do that by dollar cost averaging over a certain period of time.
Like quarterly within a year.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
That would be okay.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. I guess the idea here of the caller, and I suppose the hope of a lot of people, is that eventually things in real estate are going to turn around.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. But no one knows when. And remember, REITs are a little bit different. REITs are essentially publicly traded companies that are investing in farmland, hotels, shopping centers, apartment complexes, warehouses, etc. We're not talking about typically single-family dwellings here where credit has been extended ridiculously to people who should have never received that credit in the first instance. But naturally, the whole real estate industry is being dragged down.
Yeah.
So we have the REITs being dragged down in what? Sympathetic reaction?
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. A little bit past the midpoint here. Again, just quickly to introduce again our guest, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign and on line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a question regarding purchasing a vacation home. If you have, you know, you're not extremely wealthy, but you're, you know, comfortable, you're paying all your bills, you're paying your Visa bill and paying your mortgage and all that comfortably.
Okay.
And you have a little extra money, and you've always sort of wanted a vacation home in Michigan, but never thought you could afford it. Is this the time to consider doing that, given the fact that, you know, the real estate market is going down? I mean, should we be looking for a vacation home, and or should we pay off our mortgage more?
Well, I think that's an individual decision. You have to think long and hard about, are we in a financial position to purchase a vacation home, and if we are, what kind of money can we really afford? That's a whole separate issue. That's a whole separate issue. Now,
how do you decide that, though?
How do you decide that?
You know, like if you have to have like a financial counselor or something.
Well, I think you really need to sit down with someone who can analyze this for you dispassionately, unemotionally, and say, look, you need to be saving more for retirement, et cetera.
Yeah.
Now, if you're viewing a vacation home, I think today you have to view a vacation home basically as, gee, this is something we want to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And not so much as a huge inflation hedge into the future. You really can't do that, because by the time you get finished paying the real estate taxes, the mortgage payment, et cetera, you're going to find that there may be alternative investments that might even do better than a vacation home.
No, I mean, you have to really want the vacation.
Absolutely. Are you willing to rent the vacation home out?
Yes.
All right. So you would be looking at a home that you would be renting part-time.
Yeah, I think that would make sense.
Okay. So here are some things to remember. If you were going to rent it, you're really talking about an income property. Okay?
Okay.
Because you'd be depreciating the property. You'd be taking an interest write-off on the property. You'd be taking a real estate tax write-off on the property. And you, of course, would be declaring all rental income. If you're going to own a property in Michigan, that means you're probably going to have someone manage it for you, look after it for you. So there are a lot of hidden costs in maintaining a vacation home.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, if you are going to purchase a vacation home, Michigan is certainly an area where prices are coming down. And frankly, I think they're going to be lower 6 months from now than they are today.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
So I probably wouldn't buy today. I'd still wait.
So the deal is you take people to discuss these issues in your office?
Mm-hmm. I think there are any number of financial advisors.
So all of us who are like dying to come in and talk to you can schedule our appointments. Okay.
Well, what I'm saying is that there are a number of financial advisors in Champaign-Urbana, in addition to myself, I'm sure, who are very talented and could help you with this
area.
Yeah,
although some of them, when I come to see them, don't seem so intelligent as you do on the radio.
Oh.
So thanks.
Okay. Bye. A pleasure talking with you, and good luck.
We'll continue next. We'll talk with someone in Marshall. This is line number 4. Hello.
Dr. Sinnoh, thank you. Question for you. I'm beginning retirement at age 60. I have no debts. I have a modest diversified portfolio. One of my assets I inherited are gold maple leaves, and they've hugely appreciated, so there would be a lot of capital gain if I sold them. So my question is, would you recommend selling some or all of them, and what is the best way to sell? I don't even know how to sell gold. Just take it to the bank?
No, you don't take it to the bank.
Oh,
there are gold brokers in major cities that will buy it very, very close to the spot price of gold.
Okay. You'll
have to pay a little bit of a commission. But first of all, I would look at the entire size of my portfolio.
Yes.
That's number one. And to the extent that you have more than a 5 to 10% position in gold as a percentage of your total portfolio.
No, I'm sure I don't.
Okay. Then I'm not so concerned. If you had, 4 or 5% in gold, that's okay. Now, here's something else. I mean, again, I don't have a crystal ball,
right. But
I think capital gains rates are probably about as low as they're going to go.
Okay.
I just have this feeling that the United States has a voracious need for money, and that given the political atmosphere of this country, it wouldn't surprise me that a couple of years from now we had higher income tax rates
mm-hmm. And
even higher capital gains rates.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, if I was going to take some profits, and certainly in retirement, maybe you have a lower income in retirement,
right. That
you're probably in your lowest capital gains tax rate that you're ever going to find yourself.
Okay.
So if I were going to sell, I would contact some of the gold brokers that you could even Google them. It's
okay. Not
very hard to find.
Okay.
And you can talk to them over the phone. And
okay.
But I wouldn't do any business over the phone. I would be in the city and I would do it in person. Et cetera. I wouldn't just send my gold out through the mail, anything like that. So I would do it in person. And I might even dollar cost average out. In other words, we have gold pretty close to record highs on a day-to-day basis. So I might say, well, gee, I'm going to sell $10,000 of gold. I'm going to sell $2,500 in January and $2,500 in February and $2,500 in March and April. So I sort of average out in the price.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Right, thank you. We'll continue. And our next caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yes, Professor. I guess you might call me the Grinch who stole Christmas. So that's not a happy position, but I definitely pragmatic notions have to kick in. I just heard before, I think on the news before your show came on, that we had record consumer spending.
We did.
I believe in November. Well, that doesn't make me feel happy because I read an article in the business section of the New York Times yesterday or day before that we are a country where consumers overborrow and overspend and do relatively little savings. And that could portend difficulty more than we are in now if we don't change that mindset. So I'm asking you, I find all this hellacious spending and Christmas and all through the year and borrowing money and not saving, how do you look at that in terms of the financial health of our nation?
Well, I think the financial health of our nation is in deep trouble. That's the bottom line. And I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see capital moving out of the United States. And we essentially have what's called a level playing field all over the world, that lots and lots of players are out there with lots of capital. And now the United States doesn't have the capital. We're seeing sovereign nations with the capital. Why? Because we spend a whole lot more than we save. We import a whole lot more than we export. So as a result, there are net dollars moving out of the country. And what are these net dollars doing? They're building new companies directly to compete with us as a nation, and they are investing in our companies as well. And that doesn't bode well. I'm very, very fearful about that. Now, in the short run, consumer spending is probably a good thing if we would save as well as spend. Now, it seems difficult to do both, but we need to do both because, obviously, consumer spending is something that drives our economy as well and provides jobs in our economy. But in the long run, just like the government, where we're running a $9 trillion deficit, that can't be a good thing. It simply can't. And what it really means is that someone else ends up with the capital,
yeah. And
someone else is building the new companies and the businesses. And the real fear is that the hallmark of the United States, which has always been technology and innovation, okay, in addition to capital. But at least we've had an edge on technology and innovation that we're even losing that. It's a big-time problem, and obviously you don't hear any of the 10 or 15 political candidates talking about those issues.
Absolutely.
That obviously concern you and concern me.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. And again, we have a number of callers here. We have, moving now into about our last 15 minutes, David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month on Friday, he's here. We talk about money management issues. So if you have some kind of practical question, you're thinking about doing something in particular with your money, and you're looking for some advice, this is one stop on the process that you can make. You can call in and talk with Dave, and I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Iroquois County is our next caller, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the living trust.
Yes.
We cashed in most of our stocks and bonds to put into our retirement home. Now, we have a will with our kids as beneficiary.
Yes.
And short-term nursing home policies.
Yes.
But I know if you end up going on public aid, they get your house.
Well, if neither of the spouses is living in the house.
Okay, both of them.
Okay, but if that's the case. But interestingly enough, under Medicaid rules, you can have a very substantial amount of equity in your house so long as one spouse is living in the house. And that's equity of over $400,000. That's a little known fact. So that's, but once neither spouse is living in the house and it is unlikely that either spouse would return to the house, then Medicaid can grab that equity.
Okay, what if you put it in a living trust?
Well, if you put it in a living trust, that still really doesn't work because a living revocable trust is basically assets in your name. Now, if you put it in an irrevocable trust, which I'm not suggesting that you do, there is still about a six-year waiting period. There's a look-back period. So it used to be a three-year look-back period. Now there's a six-year look-back period for people who put assets into an irrevocable trust. So if today I had $500,000 and I put them in an irrevocable trust, which means that once I put them in there, I can't change the provisions of that trust, even if I'm the current beneficiary, but ultimately I can't change anything. And then I would have to wait 6 years, or someone would have to pay for the next 6 years if I went into a nursing home before I could then access Medicaid under current rules. Because when you fill out the application, it'll say, have you put any money in a revocable trust or an irrevocable trust during the last 72 months? Why, yes, I have. And then they'll say, oh, my, you're not eligible for Medicaid.
Okay, but
until that's used up.
But if you put it in an irrevocable trust, the house, which is mainly where our money is, and 6 years later, you're both in a nursing home, that still would not protect it from...
Oh, after 6 years it would.
It would after
That's under
years.
Current rules. Now, I can only speak from current rules.
Yeah. So one spouse went in a nursing home, and the other spouse was still living in the home for another 6 years. And
right.
And that spouse had to go in a nursing home, and he ran out of money. If the house was in a revocable trust, it would protect it.
Yes, so it
that
would.
Our children would get it.
Right, as long as 6 years have passed.
Uh-huh.
Or your children would have to pay for that nursing home. Maybe they would take a mortgage against the property or something to pay for that until that 6 year period passed.
So would that be a good idea for someone with a modest income like we?
I think there's much more to this. I think that's a pretty radical move. And I'm not sure that that really makes sense. I think that you would need to sit down with your counsel, professional counsel, a lawyer, for example, who specializes in this area, to counsel you. I really don't have enough facts and about your particular circumstances to suggest that that was a good idea. I'm just simply telling you what the law is.
And then I also heard that one of the kids would have to live in the house if it was in a living trust and went to the kids, that one of them would have to live in the house?
That's not true.
No.
That is not true. You could have any asset in a living trust. You could have your personal residence in a living trust. You wouldn't want your kids in the house while you're there.
No.
I don't think. No. No, it wouldn't be necessary. The point is that under insurance law, once a house becomes vacant, insurance companies get concerned. And they say, oh my, if no one is living in this house for 90 days, and in some cases up to 120 days, why, you don't have insurance coverage anymore.
Oh.
Ah, that's the big rub, right?
Oh.
So you have to have someone either looking in the house on a daily basis, which you can verify with your insurance company. Otherwise, it's like a vacant house. And vacant houses have this proclivity to catch on fire, be vandalized, have damage, and insurance companies do not want to take that kind of risk.
Okay.
Understand?
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
My
pleasure.
And let's see. We'll talk next with somebody in Normal, line number 3. Hello.
Yes, I had a couple questions. The first is the couch potato allotment on the website?
Yes, it is. And as a matter of fact, I gave to the WILL folks just this morning the updated number. So hopefully those will be posted sometime in the next day or so, and they should be through December 20th, through yesterday's close. So we'll show you exactly the percentages of what goes into the couch potato portfolio.
Okay. And my other question was, I didn't quite understand the part at the start about the Treasury.
Oh, Treasury money markets?
If you wouldn't mind explaining that.
Sure. Well, in a nutshell, there are many, many folks in this country who place their money in mutual funds, and one type of mutual fund is a money market fund. All right? And you usually get a checkbook with this kind of mutual fund, so you can write checks against your money market fund. And each month, this particular money market fund pays dividends. Really, it's the interest on the securities that money market holds. Incidentally, you can have a money market fund down at your local bank, which is FDIC insured up to $100,000 typically. So that certainly is another choice. Historically, though, national money market funds have paid higher interest rates on lesser sums of money than bank money market funds. So that's a lot of the reason that people seem to invest in these national money market funds. Well, what securities are held by these national money market funds? Bank certificates of deposit from major money center banks, bank repos, which are another form of security, and finally, commercial paper, which is short-term IOU paper from major corporations in the United States. And all I'm saying is while these have been very, very safe in the past, that some of these securities in these national money market funds probably, indeed, have exposure to the mortgage crisis. So as a result, I have moved my money and my clients' money to another kind of national money market fund, which simply invests your money in U.S. Treasury bills. And U.S. Treasury bills are backed by the full faith and credit of our government. So they're a little bit safer, and because they're safer, less risk means less return. So they pay a lower interest rate. I hope that explains it.
Okay, so for instance, I have a fund where they move money. They have some formula or something. I've just got a little money in there. And they look at, I have picked a fund that is the money is normally in, and then if it looks bad economically, then they quickly move it all to a money market fund. So they are in charge of moving it from one extreme to the other.
Right, and most mutual funds do that. You have what's called an actively managed mutual fund. It almost sounds like a timing mutual fund where you're either all in the market or all out of the market. Is that the case?
That's the case.
Okay, well, that's a pretty dicey fund. How is that done?
Well, this year, because of the fund that I picked, the Alger, or
mm-hmm.
I don't know what
mm-hmm.
exactly Alger fund, it was up, like, way big. So it's in the fund right now as opposed to in the money market part.
Okay.
You know, it didn't do so well because I did it right after 9/11
or okay.
whatever, and so it mm-hmm. coasted pro, but now it's
doing well.
Very active because every time they go back in, they're buying at a cheaper price.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's,
well, that's certainly a strategy. That's one strategy.
Yeah.
It's not a conservative strategy. That's a very aggressive strategy. But as long as you're comfortable with it and understand it, mm-hmm. Then you can countenance it.
So what kind of a money market would they be moving it into?
I have no idea. You'd have to call them and ask.
So that's
the question.
Which kind?
Okay. Yes.
So that would be a good question.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Next is line number 1. Someone listening in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I have a question, too. The first one is, I have heard other commentators say that the United States economy is bigger than the next 5 biggest combined. Is that a true statement, do you think?
I'm not certain. I would have to look it up. I mean, it depends. If we look at the GDP of the United States, which is, depending on whose numbers you believe, around $14 trillion, and then you look at the next largest economies and see whether those five, I would just simply have to look it up. That's an interesting academic question. I don't know the answer to it. Okay. Have you done the research?
No, I've heard somebody, but, you know, it's easy to talk. The next question I had was, once all this capital, let's say like Chinese manufacturing money or Arab petrodollars, it flows out of the country to places like Bahrain or back to China. They don't have the safe investments that we do, and I suspect a lot of it comes right back into our country.
Of course. A great deal of it comes back in the form of treasuries to fund our debt. And now a great deal of it is moving into our major companies in this country as a result of our mortgage crisis.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but to me that's a good sign. That means the rest of the world not only has confidence to put their capital here, but now they're invested in our success. Like, it doesn't do them any good for us to do bad.
Well, I'm not disagreeing, but here's two additional points. One is that most of these countries now are moving out of treasuries and holding euros. That's suggesting that they have less belief in the future viability, at least of our treasury money markets and our currency. That's a problem. And number two, while economically it's a good thing to have countries investing all over the world, including the United States, which has always been historically the largest investor in other countries, that's a good thing. I'm concerned about the political ramifications. That's my concern, is where we're moving trillions of dollars into U.S. companies by foreign governments. You see, historically, what has happened is when the U.S. invests in foreign countries, that's not our government investing. That's private money investing. Okay? Here we've got the China Sovereign Wealth Fund, which basically is controlled by the Chinese government investing. That's different.
So you're afraid they're going to manipulate our economy?
I'm afraid that when foreign governments are directly investing their hard-earned money into our corporations, that it can become too cozy a relationship and it can have political ramifications. Okay? That's my concern. I hope I'm wrong.
If you noodle with the United States economy, you tug the tiger by the tail. Like, our economy does not have the weaknesses that the Chinese do. I mean, they can't even feed themselves.
I'm not disagreeing with any of that. I'm simply pointing out that huge amounts of governmental money that is controlled by these foreign governments are pouring into U.S. corporations. That's all. And they're becoming shareholders in these corporations. This is unprecedented in our history.
Oh, let me tell you, I love when you come on the show. You're my favorite.
Thank you so much.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Well, thanks. So we'll get one more caller here. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi, this is Vincent. Hi, this is Vincent Champagne. Are you with me?
Yes, go ahead.
Thanks. Very briefly, and I know we're coming down on time. My wife and I are about to receive a real estate, a piece of property, a townhouse from my mom out of state. She had that in an irrevocable spendthrift trust, my wife being the trustee. The attorney who drew up the trust said that my wife, as the trustee, has the power to sell or deed the property to us individually, to the two of us individually, and that we won't have to pay like a gift tax on it because it's coming to us, and my mom will be able not to have to pay a tax because it's in a trust, and she can take like up to $1 million deduction.
That's correct. That is correct. If the trustee deeds the asset to both of you, say in joint tenancy with a right of survivorship, then your mother is still living?
Yes.
Okay, then your mother would file a gift tax return based upon the fair market value of that particular asset. Let's say it's $200,000, and she would use up some of her unified tax credit, which she would otherwise use as part of her estate tax deduction.
Her whole estate is under $1 million, so basically,
so then there's no tax,
taxable,
no tax, no tax.
My last question
there's a disadvantage in doing that. Let me tell you the disadvantage.
Mother.
your tax basis in that property is going to be the lower of the fair market value of that property or her basis in the property.
Her original basis.
Her original basis. That's correct.
7 years ago was 138.
Okay.
Or our basis is 138.
That's correct.
Not necessarily 160.
Correct.
What it's worth now.
Correct. She's going to file a tax return on 160. Your basis is going to be 138. Now, there's not a lot of difference there. So it's not a big deal, but I'm just pointing out the difference.
Thank you. I don't mean to speak over you. My wife is listening on the radio. So the 138 will be our tax basis, not something we pay taxes on. So if we sell the property for 158, then we would owe taxes based on the $20,000 difference.
You have it.
Okay. You know what? My wife is listening to you. What is your name, sir?
My name is David Sinnoh.
Do you have a website?
I don't. Okay. I can be contacted off the air. WILL has the information.
Thank you so much. You're very good at what you at the information you provide. And I worked as a claim adjuster. You are so right when you say that the property is vacant for over 90 days. Look out. And nobody picks up on that stuff. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're just about the point where we need to finish up here. Any last thing that you want to leave with folks?
Well, it's not too late. It's only December 21. So if you are still charitably minded, you can still receive a tax deduction for making charitable contributions to your favorite charity. And don't forget, if you're over 70 and a half and you have to take IRA distributions, you can take up to $100,000 of IRA distributions and essentially have those checks made out to your favorite charity, and then you don't have to pay any income tax on those distributions. So it's a great way to give money to charity if you are so contemplating giving money to charity by doing it through your IRA so long as you're at least 70 and a half years of age. Otherwise, David, have a great holiday season. Best wishes to you and Celeste. It's always fun doing this program.
All right. Thanks very much, Dave Sinnoh, the clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. He's with us once a month, always on a Friday, to do these shows. Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 25th anniversary of offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana. Bodywork now is an office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. We will break, as we usually do, for news and update on the markets, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Stuart Peterson. For over 20 years, Stuart Peterson has helped farmers manage both marketing opportunities and risks through their analysis, advice, and action. Stuart Peterson's team of experts and strategic consulting approach utilize the latest technology. Stuart Peterson, confidence like never before. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session at the Chicago Board of Trade. Corn futures are moderately higher, with new life of contract highs set in most months as speculative buying is pushing prices higher. We're seeing that some subdued trading is existing. This is not to be surprised at all. We're at the beginning of the holiday season. Thin volume trade to date. Most traders not at the Chicago Board of Trade.